From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. A 21% reduction in Medicare reimbursements to physicians took effect this month, and some say it could push doctors to limit the number of Medicare patients they see. We'll talk today with the director of the Center for Medicare Management, the president of the Lee County Medical Society, and the AARP of Florida's state director about how the reimbursement cuts will affect the medical community, local economies, and access to care. And it's Tuesday, so we'll get an update from Tallahassee from Republican State Representative Gary Aubuchon of Cape Coral for our weekly look at the 2010 legislative session. First, this news update. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. The Florida House and Senate have finalized their budget proposals for the coming fiscal year. Later in the show, we'll talk with Republican State Representative Gary Aubuchon about the struggle in Tallahassee to balance the budget by the end of the legislative session with a projected revenue shortfall of more than $3 billion. But first, when it comes to health care, the nation's attention has largely been on the Health Care and Education Affordability Reconciliation Act championed by the Obama administration. But many physicians are concerned about a more immediate issue, a 21% reduction in Medicare reimbursement to doctors, which took effect April 1st. Some say it could force doctors to limit the number of Medicare patients they treat. We'll look at why those reimbursement cuts are taking effect now and how they might affect the medical community, as well as local economies and access to medical services. We'll also look at how Medicare reimbursement rates could affect health insurance premiums, even for people not enrolled in Medicare. My first guest is the director for the Center of Medicare Management in Baltimore, John Blum. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you for having me today.
Oh, thank you for being here. And if you're one of the 46 million Americans covered by Medicare, give us a call. How do you think changes to Medicare reimbursement rates will affect you? Our studio lines are open. The number is 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Or email your questions and comments to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. And John, before we get into the discussion, let's get a little background on how the Medicare reimbursement reduction came about. This 21% cut has been delayed three times already in recent months, but now it's taken effect as of April 1st. How did we get to this point?
Well, I think this issue stems back from for the past 10 years or so, where Congress has tried to put in control on overall physician spending by creating what's called the so-called sustainable growth rate, which produces an overall check on total physician payments paid by the Medicare program. Each year, Congress has delayed this check from going into place, which creates a bigger funding hole year after year. So today the funding hole is so big that if Congress fails to act, CMS, the agency that runs the Medicare program, will have to reduce physician payments by about 21%.
And let's talk more about the sustainable growth rate formula, because there has been a criticism. I know the people have been calling it a flawed formula, a flawed system. Do you think that holds true?
I do. I think we have seen this payment mechanism cause Congress to have to come back year after year to either do a short-term extension or a longer-term extension. But I think from our perspective here at CMS, we want to see a permanent fix to the SGR. We want to see a permanent payment change for physician payments to provide stability and to allow physicians to understand well in advance how much CMS will pay for their services.
And without a long-term fix, how would that impact the solvency of the Medicare program?
Well, I think first of all, there's no thought whatsoever by anybody that Congress will allow the 21% cut to go into effect. So our projections for long-term Medicare solvency tend to assume that Congress will fix this payment cut. But if Congress fails to address it, then we have to assume that more physicians will drop out of the program, that beneficiaries will have problems to access a physician. So our goal is to ensure that Congress understands that this payment change has to be made, and that physicians need predictability to how they'll be paid by the Medicare program.
So do you think at this point you're saying there is a good chance that this 21% cut could be further delayed or eliminated?
I am very confident that Congress will act. The question is when they will act. So the payment cut went into effect on Thursday, April 1st. CMS has the authority to hold physician claims for about 10 business days. And given that Congress is now on recess, CMS took the prudent step to hold physician claims for 10 business days. Now, the law requires CMS to pay claims after the 14th day that is received. So this payment hold will have no impact on physicians' cash flows. So CMS has taken this action to give Congress more time to act. So we're hoping that when Congress returns next week, that they will act very quickly to address the 21% shortfall.
Okay, so there's the 10-day hold that you've put on, and then you said the original, like, 14 days. So does that, you add those together, so they've got until about the 14th to act on this?
Sure. So to our minds, we've taken the step to hold claims for 10 business days, and we're hoping that next week Congress comes back, that they will act very quickly.
Okay. If they don't act, I guess if they don't remove this, I mean, are you fearful of what could happen?
Well, I think there is a very strong fear that if the 21% cut were to go into effect, that more physicians would choose to drop out of the Medicare program, that it is a voluntary decision to participate within the Medicare program. Now, the vast majority of physicians today choose to participate within the program, but if the reimbursement is cut, we'll have to assume that more physicians will decide to drop out. We'll also have to assume that more beneficiaries will have difficulty getting access to care. More beneficiaries will go to the ER to seek care rather than to their physician office. So to our mind, we have to be concerned about beneficiary access. We have to be concerned that if the 21% cut were to go into effect, that it would have severe disruptions for our beneficiaries.
It sounds like besides those severe disruptions, it would also just be more expensive if people are going to the ER instead
Correct.
Of their primary doctor.
Correct. So I think a long-term goal of the health reform bill is to promote more primary care, to promote more early intervention, to promote more prevention. And so to ensure those goals, we have to make sure that physicians are paid fairly, that they have predictability to their payment rates, and to help ensure the long-term cost savings that will occur with the health reform legislation, we have to ensure that our beneficiaries have the best access to prevention, to primary care services, and to early access to their physician, because we know that's going to help solve the long-term cost issues that we have with the Medicare program.
And can you tell us more about the link between this measure and the Health Care and Education Affordability Reconciliation Act?
Well, I think part of the goal to the health reform legislation is to promote access to those who are uninsured, but the other part is to help to reduce overall health care costs, to promote more prevention, to promote more wellness. The program that I oversee, the Medicare program, has been criticized for not promoting wellness, but promoting just health care. And so we know that the program needs to focus more on prevention, on wellness, on chronic management for chronic disease. And in order to ensure that can happen, we need to ensure we have a good supply of physicians, primary care physicians, and so we need to ensure that they're paid fairly, that they're paid predictably, and that will help to achieve some of these long-term goals that we have with the health reform legislation.
And assuming that this 21% reduction is taken back by an act of Congress before the 14th, do you feel like the way the system is now, that physicians practicing primary care or not even necessarily primary care, but just who take Medicare patients are satisfied with the system?
Well, I think putting aside the 21% issue for a second. Mm-hmm. I think that we also have other issues in the Medicare program. We have an oversupply of certain specialists, and we have an undersupply of primary care physicians. And that's not just true with the Medicare program, but true with the entire healthcare system. There are some very important provisions throughout the health reform legislation that will help to elevate the supply of primary care physicians. Part of that is reimbursement. Part of that is dollars for physician training. I think another issue we have to address is that our fee-for-service healthcare system that we have with the Medicare system, but the entire healthcare delivery system, is that it tends to promote services rather than promoting wellness or healthcare outcomes. Part of the goal that we have with the fee-for-service Medicare program is to create more incentives to reward value, to reward quality, and so over time, CMS will be putting in new payment systems that will help promote not just the delivery of care, but the outcome of care, to ensure that our beneficiaries, but all users of the healthcare system, get better quality outcomes, get more focused on prevention, wellness, rather than just getting care when they get sick. And that's going to help to achieve, the overall cost control that we want with the Medicare program, but the entire healthcare delivery system.
John, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. That was Director of the Center for Medicare Management, John Blum. We're talking about the 21% reduction in Medicare reimbursements to physicians that were enacted on April 1st. Joining me now is the president of the Lee County Medical Society, Dr. Craig Sweet, and Lori Parnum, AARP of Florida's State Director. Dr. Sweet, Dr. Parnum, welcome to the show.
Good day.
All right. And Dr. Parnum, do I have you as well?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Okay, great, great. Are you a Medicare subscriber? Do you have questions about how these reductions in physician reimbursements could affect your health care? To join the discussion, give us a call at 1-877-GCU-TALK. That's 1-877-428-8255. Or send us an email, gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. And Dr. Sweet, I wanted to start off with you. Do you have any ideas as to why my first guest would, from the Centers for Medicare Management, wouldn't be on the program with a physician?
No, I'm not sure. And interestingly, a lot of what he said, I think we're all in agreement with. The SGR, the sustainable growth rate, this formula that was designed in the late 1990s, has, I think, and he agreed that it is a flawed formula requiring a change, and the Congress really has not been able to agree on a change or agree in enforcing the formula for a number of years. The idea of the formula, as I understand it, is that they looked at actual expenditures for Medicare versus target expenditures, and they looked all the way actually back in 1996 to the end of the most recent year. And what they said was that if the actual expenditures exceeded the target, that the physicians would proactively give the money back. Now, that's an interesting issue. When you look at all of the Medicare spending, physicians account for only about 5% of the Medicare spending. But we are, I think, the low-hanging fruit. We're easy to pluck at. And so, therefore, they were going to penalize the physicians for overspending. Now, that formula included a lot of things that didn't make a lot of sense. For example, some pharmaceutical costs that physicians administer within their offices, that was part of the formula. And we couldn't control any of those costs. That's not under our control. In addition, the formula really didn't take into account what would happen with preventative treatments, for example, increasing colonoscopies for colon cancer and increasing mammography for breast cancer. You start screening, we start finding. We start finding, we start treating. And so the increased costs that would occur, that wasn't really part of the formula. So it was clear that once they started doing that, that the expenditures would go up. But they tried to penalize the doctors for those particular problems. And that really wasn't fair. And over the years, since 2001 is where the target and the actual expenditures really started to separate. That was the time. And then it separated further and further and further up to this point in time. So now the separation is so high, it's this 21.2%. This formula, this flawed formula, will institute a reduction in payments to physicians. There are many practices that are just getting by these days, especially in this extraordinarily depressed economy in Southwest Florida. And a reduction like that will truly be catastrophic to not just the physician practices. We're kind of a resilient group. We'll figure out something. But to our patients, where are they going to go? Access will fall. Quality of care will fall. How much longer is it going to take for them to get in to see a doctor once they can even find a doctor? So the consequences of this reduction, if the Senate, it's really the Senate's responsibility right now, if they don't do something for, you know, to fix this, we have grave concerns that we will be hurt. This community will be hurt. Our patients will be harmed.
And I see that there's actually form letters to Senator Lemieux and Senator Nelson, kind of that I guess you're giving to patients as well to I guess get them up to speed on the issue and get them to help lobby the Senate to pass this?
Yes, sir. The Lee County Medical Society, we put together these letters, and the Independent Physician Association of Lee County, IPALC, also has these letters on the website. And I just saw a new petition, I hope, that is on the website. It's called an iPetition. It was actually started through the Texas Medical Association. These are all methods for patients, because this is affecting patients. These are methods for patients to make their voices known, for or against, whatever it is, they need to make their voices known.
And going back to something you had said just a little bit earlier, talking about, you know, doctors who are just getting by, do you mean are these folks who are generally not making money because of Medicare reimbursements, or are these docs making less than they used to?
It's both. At Medicare, from 2001 to 2009, Medicare increased their payments or reimbursements by 1%. That's it, 1%. Our practice expenses on average, you know, a little lower for some, higher for others, went up 22%. We've already had a 21% reduction over these past 9 years. So suddenly, they're talking about reducing it a big chunk further. So the margin for physicians to be able to keep their practices open and buy capital expenditures and to survive has dropped steadily year after year after year, not even coming close. 1% is not even close to the 22%. It is not even close to medical inflation or even general inflation. So we've been getting cut year after year after year, and so the margin has gotten tighter and tighter and tighter. I'm sure your listeners would say that the amount of time that they spent with their doctor in 2001 was more than the amount of time that they're able to spend with their doctors now. Because doctors are forced to see patients, more patients, because the margins are so slim, and they can't keep their doors open if they can't see enough patients. There probably have been some increased efficiencies, and hopefully they're still able to keep the time, but there have been studies that the amount of time has decreased slightly. I think everybody's trying to do the best they can, but it's very, very, very difficult when the margin is so small that it gets so close that one can almost lose money on seeing some of these patients. And we can't keep our doors open. We can't service the patients in Southwest Florida if that's the case. And that will be the case if the Senate doesn't act as soon as they get back. And I got to tell you, I'm not convinced. I mean, I hope that Mr. Blum is correct, that they're going to act. But the fact, they didn't, okay? This kicked in a month ago. The SGR kicked in on March 1st. And then they kicked the can. They didn't fix it. They just moved the deadline further, and eventually it was settled on April Fool's Day. Great, April Fool's Day. And it kicked in again. And it's only because CMS has been able to hold those 10 business days that we are not seeing these immediate reductions. I think there's one other point that's really important, too, and that is that we're not really just talking about Medicare. Nearly all insurance companies reimburse to what's called Medicare allowable rates. And that is, they use Medicare as their yardstick, as their standard. Medicare drops 21%. Reimbursement for all insurances drop 21%. And that, again, will be an extraordinary burden to this community. I think one of the first things that will happen is that if this isn't fixed, is that the doctors are going to have to let some staff go.
And not the best thing to do for a region with almost 20% unemployment rate.
I utterly feel that way. I mean, let's face it. I think it's teachers, education, and medicine in this community that are the top employers and with the most amount of economic input within the region. I think medicine's actually first, but I think numerically, number of people hired, I think teachers or education is first. So either way, we're up in that area. And then suddenly you hit, again, not just Medicare, but all reimbursement, nearly all reimbursement, except not Medicaid and self-pay. But you take a gigantic chunk, you'll knock everybody down, and then suddenly, I mean, what are the doctors going to do? They want to care for their patients. We are sworn to care for our patients. They're going to want to keep the doors open. And many, many practices have already become very lean because the economy here is so tight, so tough. So what are they going to do? They're going to lose more people. So there's going to be a greater unemployment issue in this community. I think that's one of the early things. And the later things are, or shortly thereafter, is not participating in Medicare and then not being able to offer some of the services and not buying the capital equipment to make the diagnoses that our patients are expecting from us.
I want to get into that there with the PAR versus non-PAR options and what your different things are. First, real quick, I want to bring Dr. Parham into the conversation. Getting the point of view from the AARP, have they taken an official position on this move?
Good morning. Yes, we have. I mean, this fix is hugely important to our members. The relationship that our members have with their doctors is right up there with the relationship they have with their grandchildren. It's hugely important to them, and they want to be able to see the doctor they've been seeing for years and to have the choice to see the doctor they want to see. So we are definitely working on this issue. We are urging the Senate to take action. We had hoped that this fix would have been part of health reform. And, you know, the temporary repairs and the month-to-month extensions only really serve to further the anxiety of Medicare recipients and drive up the price tag of future patches.
How many Medicare subscribers are we talking about here in Florida?
Oh, in Florida, we are one of the largest populations of Medicare beneficiaries, around 3 million. Who rely on the Medicare program. And we also know that in talking earlier with the gentleman that Medicare beneficiaries, they are the happiest with their health care overall. And this program is important to them. And if we aren't paying physicians appropriately, this is they've got enough concern right now. They've got enough worry. And this is not one we need to add.
And like Dr. Sweet was mentioning, I mean, is this something that you think could seriously have an impact on, I guess not just seniors, but anyone getting Medicare benefits, TRICARE, that would reduce their access to health care?
Well, that is a real concern for beneficiaries, and there are, in the healthcare reform legislation, there are provisions that are really working to focus on access to primary care and prevention, and that's great. That's an important component going forward. But if we don't fix this problem, and if we don't move away from these short-term fixes, if we don't look at changes that are really going to provide a long-term solution and sustainability, then that's not good for beneficiaries, and it's not good for the overall sustainability of Medicare.
Mm-hmm. And as you had sort of mentioned before about Medicare recipients being the most satisfied with their care, I read a recent news press article here citing a report on Medicare from 2009 by MedPAC, the group that advises Congress on Medicare issues, saying that you know, those patients are more than 75% of them covered by Medicare, have no delays in getting appointments for routine care. 84% they had adequate access to emergency care. Given all of that, could the projected negative impact of this, if the Senate fails to act, be somewhat overinflated, or do you think we might be underestimating how bad it could be?
Well, you know, I think it's an issue that needs to be fixed. I don't want to frighten people. There's a lot of uncertainty at the moment. There's a lot of misinformation out there around the impacts of reform on the Medicare program. In January, the Senate passed legislation that would set aside another patch for the system. We want to get away from patches. We want to get this fixed. There is the potential to get this done. I think it's great that the physician community is reaching out to Medicare beneficiaries. We have also been reaching out to our members about the importance of this issue, and I think we need to focus on getting this done.
And Dr. Sweet, I wanted to bring you back into it. How would you, I guess, gauge the reaction of the medical community? Are we sweating bullets here? Are there really people who, with this reduction, would have to seriously look at closing up shop?
I agree with the idea of not panicking. I do agree that we shouldn't overemphasize these issues.
Mm-hmm.
I do feel, though, because I guess I'm not as trusting of the political climate up in Washington. I am very concerned that there's now a greater emphasis to really look at balancing the budget. And how better to do this than, you know, on the shoulders of those quote-unquote rich doctors. I mean, what a joke these days. They continue to have lower and lower reimbursements. So that's just not the case anymore. And I know there are practices. I know there are practices whose margins are in the upper teens or 20%. You knock them down, they're down. They will close their doors. They absolutely will close their doors. And I think most doctors, to be honest with you, they're thinking, okay, it's going to be another reduction, that my income is going to be dropping another 21%. And they'll weather that storm. They'll somehow survive. They'll somehow get through. The problem is that that's not really what the math shows. What the math shows, on average, is that just picking out average numbers, is if $1,000 is provided for some, you know, a complex procedure by Medicare, doctors' expenses on average will be about $720. Okay. Now, suddenly that 1,000 is no longer 1,000. It's actually 800, even slightly less. And then suddenly the difference is now only about $70 or $80 out of 1,000. That's not enough for us to keep our doors open. And I don't, like, maybe I'm wrong here, but I don't necessarily trust the Senate, trust the House. The House really fixed this. It's the Senate's issue. The House fixed it. They tried to fix it and lock it in with GDP, gross domestic product, plus about 1% or 2%, depending on the issues. But it's the Senate that just is digging its heels in. They're the ones who let it come through. They didn't stop it. They let it go through both March 1st and April 1st. They left. They recessed without addressing this issue. They keep what we call kicking the can. They keep sending it further, letting that division get, that 21.2%, let it get wider and wider as the years go past. I'm not quite as certain that they're going to do the right thing. And, you know, it's interesting. All three of us here are saying the same thing. Mm-hmm. We're saying this needs to be fixed. I guess I'm a little more cautious and less certain that they're going to do the right thing. I think we have to tell them to do the right thing. And I think that this is a political problem, and it will only be solved through the politics of a grassroots campaign, of letting them know how important it is, and to fix it, and to fix it well, and to fix it fairly. That's all we're asking. Just fix it fairly.
to join the discussion, give us a call at 1-877-GCU-TALK. That's 877-428-8255. Or send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. We're talking about the impact of recently enacted reductions in Medicare reimbursement rates to physicians. I'm joined by Lori Parham, AARP Advocacy Manager for State Affairs here in Florida. We also have the President of the Lee County Medical Society, Dr. Craig Sweet. Are you a Medicare or TRICARE subscriber? Tell us about your experience with that health coverage. What are your concerns or questions about this change in the reimbursement schedule? That number again is 877-428-8255. And Dr. Parham, has your organization beginning inquiries from AARP members about this? Do you think it's something folks know is going on? Are they worried about it?
You know, we've been getting a lot of general questions about the health reform legislation and what it means for Medicare. We've heard less specifically on this issue, and I'm not sure how aware folks are. And I think it's good that we're all working to ensure and to educate folks about what's going on and to ask them to reach out to their senators so that we can get this done. I mean, I think that we really do need that kind of campaign. So we know folks love the program. We know how important their doctors are to them. But the senators need to hear from folks about how important the doctor-patient relationship is.
Okay, and we have a call from Marty in Fort Myers. Okay, well, we'll get to him in just a moment here. What I wanted to ask also was, you know, Dr. Sweet, from your point of view, I wanted to come back to what physicians' options would be if the Senate doesn't do anything. Can you explain for us what the PAR, non-PAR, or just opting out altogether would mean for the patients of that physician?
Well, I think I could put it into a little perspective here. I got a hold of an interesting report prepared by the Surgical Coalition. This is March, so it's very, very recent data here. And it represents about almost a quarter of a million surgeons throughout this country. And they took a poll to figure out what will be the response here. And I'd like to say it's about a rule of thirds. And right now, the vast majority, as you discussed, depending on the specialty, you know, pediatrics, for example, won't be seeing much in the way of Medicare. But most surgical specialties absolutely see Medicare up into the 80 and 90%. So they are participating. They're PAR physicians. But if this change occurs, it's about a rule of threes, I think, is how I would read it here. And that is about a third of them would remain participating. And then there would be about a third would be non-participating, and then they would just privately opt out entirely. And so there, it's a gradient of participation, it's a gradient of involvement. But before, you've got up into the 90s participating, and then suddenly that's going to change, that 90 participating, if doctors will do as they have said that they will do in this evaluation, it'll drop to a third. And that's a really big hit. Now, if you end up with about a third of the physicians opting out entirely, that's a huge change in the Medicare system, huge change.
Right. I want to take some calls right now. I want to go to Al in Estero. Al, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead, Al.
Well, I'm listening to this discussion and reminds me of years and years of doctors complaining and also their threat that they are going to pull out of a certain program and they are not making enough money. First of all, in this climate, the doctor, the president of Lee County Medical Society, is saying that their overhead is 70 plus of each dollar that they get. There is no business in the world that will survive with that type of a overhead. That's number one. Number two is that 40% of the doctor's revenue comes from Medicare. I dare Dr. Lee, Dr. the president, and all the physicians here to say that I'm going to eliminate altogether the 40% of my income through Medicare. It's a bluff. I mean, what I don't understand, when these doctors, they become a doctor, they put the uniform on, they put the stethoscope around their neck, are they preordained to make $300,000-$400,000 a year? My God, you know, the union is losing wages, the banker is losing wages, you know, the teacher is using wages, and they still complain about the fact that their income is going to go down. You see, at no time, they are talking about patient care. It is all about the money that they want to make. And it's a sad situation. I don't understand why he should make far more than a physician in Canada, in Germany, in France, and in Sweden.
Okay, thank you, Al, for your comment. Dr. Sweet, your response. It sounds like he doesn't really think it's as bad as it seems.
Yeah, you know, it's all a very interesting comment here. I've been hearing it for years and years. And first of all, he is unfortunately not correct here that the margin that suggested was not accurate. The margin is very accurate. It's not uncommon for some of the larger practices. It depends on how many physicians there are in it, that the expenses can be anywhere from 50, 60, 70, and even up to 80% of the income that's coming in. The FMA did a study that showed that we are involved in the employment, both directly or indirectly, each physician with 19 different individuals in this state. And that's through the work that we have within our practices, our hospitals. And so we are responsible for an awful lot of other people here in driving the economic engine. I think that this concern, too, that that doctors should be, you know, making much less, you know, it's a very tough discussion. First, the doctors have gone to school for many, many, many years. They come out of their education $250,000 in debt. It can take years and years to pay that back. Our medical malpractice is a huge issue. Our lives are so impacted by our jobs. You know, we work on an average of 67 hours a week, and some more and some less. It depends on the call. It can go well over 100 hours in a week.
Right.
And
I am out of time.
Our responsibility is so much higher, so it's hard to say when there are so many other people making a lot more money. I mean,
I'm sorry, Dr. Sweet. We are out of time right now. I'd love to keep the discussion going.
It's a tough discussion. But in America, a lot of people make a lot more money than a lot of other people think that they should in sports and other things, too.
Right, right. That was Lori Parham, AARP Advocacy Director for the state of Florida. And also, we were speaking with Dr. Sweet, president of the Lee County Medical Society. At the beginning of the hour, we were talking with director of the Center for Medicare Management, John Blum. We're now going to take a break and come back with our weekly look at the legislative session. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. With the April 30th deadline for Florida's legislative session looming, lawmakers are working to pass a constitutionally mandated balanced budget in the face of projected revenue shortfalls of more than $3 billion. I spoke earlier with Republican State Representative Gary Aubuchon of Cape Coral about the House's $67 billion budget proposal and other key items on the legislative agenda in Tallahassee. I know that the House passed a $67 billion budget plan. And it has some cuts that critics have called crippling, with, you know, a $450 million cut to road construction projects, a $30 per student decline in public school funding, a $130 million cut to nursing homes. But, you know, given the state of the economy and the need to pass a balanced budget, do you think these cuts are necessary?
At the end of the day, I do. Necessary is the key word there. Are they without some pain and difficulty? Absolutely not. But when the state of Florida is facing a $3.2 billion shortfall, and our citizens have clearly demonstrated and indicated that they are unable and unwilling to pay additional taxes to support the shortfall, the only way to get there is through budget reductions. And so we took on the very difficult task of determining which of those reductions we could make that would have the least impact on our school system, on our health care system and on our citizens. And at the end of the day, I believe the House has passed a responsible budget that keeps Florida in balance and allows time for economic recovery to take place.
And overall, are you satisfied with the State House's budget proposal for the coming fiscal year, or are there things you would have done differently?
Well, you know, every member has things that are important and unique to them and their constituencies, and there's 120 of us in the Florida House. So certainly at the end of the day, while there may have been individual components I would have adjusted slightly differently, at the end I'm very satisfied with the budget that the House has passed and look forward now to the process over the next several weeks of negotiating with the Senate.
Okay, and as the chairman of the House Roads, Bridges, and Ports Policy Committee, I wanted to ask you about the banning texting while driving measures and get your thoughts on that.
We passed out of our committee a proposed committee substitute to Representative Doug Holder's texting bill. There were six different bills that were initially filed in the Florida House. We conducted a workshop and took what we believed to be the best of the ideas that each bill presented, consolidated them into a single bill, and created a prohibition on texting as a secondary offense, meaning it would be against the law to text and drive should this bill become law, but it would not be something that somebody could get pulled over for. They would have had to have committed another violation first in order to be ticketed for this.
And I know critics of that have said, this doesn't go far enough and that texting while driving needs to be a primary offense. But you don't necessarily think that that would be more beneficial?
Well, there's a challenge with that, and that is we did not ban nor contemplate banning the use of cell phones while driving. And so it becomes very difficult for a law enforcement officer to know whether somebody is dialing a telephone number or sending a text mail message, as the mechanics of it are the same. So while we didn't want to get into that, what we do believe, however, is that by making it illegal, most people will comply, just like they did with the seatbelt law. But secondly, and more importantly, that we believe will drive innovation in the private sector, and this bill would eventually become obsolete by having voice-activated systems within the cars that could both read text messages as they came into the car, as well as send text messages with voice activation.
Oh, I see. So you're saying as technology improves, this might become just an antiquated issue.
Absolutely. I firmly believe that, and my hope with legislation is that we would simply accelerate that process.
If Florida adopts a cell phone texting ban that makes texting while driving a primary offense, meaning somebody could be stopped and ticketed for doing it in the absence of any other offense, if Florida makes texting a primary offense, there could potentially be some additional federal funds for road construction projects. Would that incentive be enough to push you into that camp, or do you still think it's just too difficult to enforce?
Well, I'm a realist, and within the 120 members within the Florida House, there are a wide divergence of opinions on this issue. Some people feel that it's not the state's role to get inside somebody's vehicle at all, and so primary enforcement, if we were to push for that, we would certainly lose a significant contingent of votes within the Florida House. Conversely, not doing something at all, I think, is sending the wrong message, because especially with the younger generation, we want to let them know that texting while driving is an extremely dangerous behavior, and by making it a secondary offense, even though it wouldn't be something they could get pulled over for, they would still be taught from driver's education forward that the activity would be illegal while driving, and I think that's the most important message.
And another thing I wanted to ask about was the Healthy Start coalitions. I've spoken with folks from those groups, and they're angry about having those services possibly consolidated within county health departments. Was that something you would support?
You know, that's an issue I would have to look at a little bit more. I wasn't directly involved with that discussion this legislative session up to date, so before I could really comment intelligently one way or another, I would have to look into that issue a little deeper.
Okay. As you were going through this whole process, I know passing a balanced budget is the most important thing, but were there key issues that were always at the forefront of your mind, like job creation or things like that, that were always behind the measures that you were pushing or supporting?
Absolutely. In fact, job creation has been my number one priority as I have gone through this legislative session. The first bill that I was involved with that has now passed both the House and Senate and is awaiting the governor's signature was a tort reform bill that reduced the cost of frivolous lawsuits, of defending frivolous lawsuits on Florida businesses, which instead of defending lawsuits, they can now focus their efforts on expanding within the state of Florida and creating job opportunities. So I was very pleased to bring that. It was called the slip and fall bill, but bring that one forward. I'm currently fighting for funding, even within this tight budget cycle, to support the National Swim Center in Cape Coral, working on trying to establish a state sales tax rebate program that the city of Cape Coral could use as a bondable stream of income to help underwrite the cost of that project and create jobs and economic diversity for the city. And then I'm working on, with Chairman Dean Cannon, offshore oil drilling initiatives, Medicaid reform, as well as my usual plate of affordable housing and building safety and building codes issues.
And I wanted to ask also how you felt about the Obama administration's opening up of oil drilling in federal waters off the Gulf. Was that kind of a surprising move?
Maybe not surprising, but certainly when we talk about energy, and we talk specifically about energy independence, and then this is something our nation has been fighting for since the oil embargo in the mid-70s. And more recently, energy independence has also added the additional concerns of carbon capture in the whole green movement. But really, at this point in time, almost any other form of energy created by anything other than fossil fuels is significantly more expensive than fossil fuel-created energy. And so while we certainly need to move toward a more sustainable energy source in the future, part of the way we can do that is by underwriting the cost with advanced exploration, both onshore and offshore.
Do you think that move by the Obama administration might bolster efforts within Florida to open up offshore drilling within state waters?
It may. It very well may. You know, one of the things yet to be determined by now this opening up of oil and gas exploration in the federal waters is what sort of revenue share agreement the federal government will have with the state of Florida. And so certainly one of the things we're attempting to do is both obtain energy for our future, but at the same time help underwrite the cost of government and services within the state of Florida. And it's yet to be seen what impact that will have.
I've heard conflicting reports also about how much oil is potentially within state waters. Is that something, do you think, we should study more before we move forward?
Well, I think in order to really ascertain that the answer to that question, there has to be some, at the very least, some test drilling done. And in order to do that, leases have to be auctioned off to private industry and allow the exploration to begin. So how much oil is actually out there was the subject of much debate. And to your listeners, I would tell you that if you go to myfloridahouse.gov, you can click on a link and catch the past 6 months of testimony that we have heard in the Florida House, both the video stream of that testimony as well as all the documents that we have seen, all the PowerPoint presentations and so forth. And right on the homepage to myfloridahouse.gov is a link that in the lower right-hand corner that says energy exploration. So anyone who has any interest at all in this issue, and I know many of our coastal residents do, everything you would ever want to know about energy exploration in the state of Florida is available there.
And something else, this is, I think, much less contentious than anything else we've discussed so far, but the Andrew Widman Act, that passed unanimously in the House. It's up for review in the Senate. For folks who maybe don't know, that was related to the death of Fort Myers police officer Andrew Widman in July 2008, a measure that would allow judges to keep probationers in jail if there's probable cause. Do you have any reason to think that that wouldn't pass in the Senate?
No reason whatsoever, and I think that was a very important piece of legislation. I was happy to vote for it. once again, and I salute Representative Nick Thompson for carrying forward that important issue.
And I know that most of the action in the legislature, you know, generally occurs in the final weeks, which are looming close right now.
Yes.
What does that mean for you in the coming weeks? How is that going to change how you operate, what's going to be going on there?
Well, it ramps up the energy and the amount of information that crosses my desk and every member's desk. The days will get significantly longer, and the stakes will become higher as we get closer and closer to day 60, which is the final day in session. Legislation begins to fall out, and we use the term that bills die, and they do. And so the sort of the art and science of being a legislator is making sure you're doing everything you can to keep the legislation that you are sponsoring alive and moving through the system. And I'll certainly be doing that.
One more thing. As far as property insurance legislation, do you think we need something that would allow companies to raise rates with annual caps without regulatory approval? Is that something that you would support?
It is, and it's something I supported last year. And I know on the face of it, it seems counterintuitive that we would allow insurance companies to raise rates without regulatory approval, even if it's only within a limited amount. But the fact of the matter is most of our insurance companies have left the state of Florida because the rates in which they are regulated to are not actuarially sound, and the insurance companies are not able to maintain adequate reserves. So in the case of a hurricane season like 2004, 2005, these companies would become insolvent. And so in order to foster competition and encourage the insurers to come back into the state of Florida and begin to underwrite policies once again, we're going to have to loosen up our regulatory control to some extent.
I mean, you know, and I've even heard folks on the other side of the table saying we just can't continue to push people into Citizens, because if we do get a storm, it's just going to bankrupt the state.
That's correct. And what most people who are not in Citizens don't realize is that it is truly the state of Florida's insurance company, and everybody pays. Everybody receives an assessment still on a normal homeowner's policy from the hurricane years of 2004, 2005 to underwrite the losses that Citizens endured at that time. And the state of Florida's really, it's incumbent on us to get out of the insurance business because the risk then just simply gets spread to the taxpayers rather than to insurance policyholders. So we need to get back into more of a free market enterprise system and let the market control the rates.
And one more thing I wanted to ask you about. I know the State Attorney General Bill McCollum has filed a lawsuit or joined with other state attorney generals filing a lawsuit over federal health care overhaul. And critics have said it's just political grandstanding and he should be focused on state issues. Do you support his efforts there?
I do, absolutely. And I think it boils down to, can the federal government require individuals to purchase a health insurance policy? There are some that can simply pay for their medical bills using their own funds. Why and how does the federal government believe that they can require and mandate that individuals purchase an insurance policy? And I think that at the crux of the issue is something that is absolutely worth standing up against, as the Attorney General is.
All right. Well, Representative Aubuchon, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
It's my pleasure. Nice talking to you, John.
That was State Representative Gary Aubuchon. This is WGCU 90.1, WMKO 91.7.